counters up there next to me to confirm that I was seeing a golden eagle and that, you know, what to look for, and couldn't wait for the next one. And I'm still excited every time I see one.
You mentioned a way back when with Rachel Carson's book. Can you talk to me about how you felt when that was published?
When it was first published, I suspected that it was all happening, and so many other things were happening in society and my life that I kind of went, wow, I wonder how this is going to pan out. I wonder how accurate this really is, because when one person cites an issue, you don't necessarily jump on it. You don't necessarily take it 100% to heart until you hear other sources. And at that time, a lot of the other sources, which were, of course, the chemical companies and the big business farmers that really did want to kill all the insects and so on so they could raise more crops, were putting out other information. This still happens, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So it took other environmental groups' efforts to document Rachel Carson's claims to bring it into balance with the whole situation. I'm not versed in it because I was teaching music at the time. I was aware and reading and thinking, oh my goodness, you know, what are we going to do? What's going to happen? And fortunately, the powers that be got enough power to, you know, eradicate the use of the DDT. I think it was probably the threat to humankind, especially children, that drove that, because if it could happen to birds and eagles, you know, what was the potential impact on humanity? And I think that was a big part of it.
Did you hear any people express specific fears for kids or things like that?
Yes, the fact that the DDT was into the food stream, and the fact that as people ate the food that had been protected against the insects by the DDT, it also could have been taken up through the systemic roots, you know, the root system of the plants, and could easily concentrate in humans as well, especially youngsters that are going to eat for the next how many years off the produce of those fields.
Can you tell me about your position on the board of the Delaware Otsego Audubon Society?
Sure. Right now I'm co-president, but I want you to realize that anytime you get on a board, you're instantly going to advance on that board because it's tricky these days to get active board members. It's getting more and more challenging. So I started out as a board member, secretary. Secretary was a good way to learn the workings of the club. And a few years later, I was approached about becoming a co-president. So three people are co-presidents now. And that allows a break. If somebody wants to go south for a few months, there are two other co-presidents to keep the club going and stay on top of things. And we have a lot going on. I'm also the program chairman, so that's a challenge. I, you know, arrange for programs and just send out an email today to next week's person and, you know, this, that, nuts and bolts. What do you need? We're going to be such and such a time. And I like it. I've met a lot of great people. And sometimes it feels overwhelming, and it's time well spent. We have a bird walk at the Fenmore Art Museum on Saturday in conjunction with the Otsego 2000 film series, The Messenger, and our treasurer and the two of us we're going to run that bird walk, and then we're going to table before the film, and then we're going to go to the film. So it's going to be a good nature day.
So there's that walk. What other programs are there?
Well, we run the sanctuary, which is the Hawk Watch. There are trails
in Oneonta?
This is in Oneonta on Grange Halsper Road. We have a terrific website, which is doas.us. We run educational programs. We have environmental grant, which is made available to classroom teachers who apply and for classroom projects. We have, we have a ton of stuff. We do a lot of bird walks, a lot of field trips. We have an owl trip coming up pretty soon. Outreach. We have a terrific newsletter with lots of environmental information in it. We have a ton of stuff. DOAS.us, it's incredible.
Which classroom projects have been funded in the past?
Let's see. There's a teacher, I believe, in Andes, who is interested in having research on fish release. She teaches her kids all about fish to be released in the waterway, and then, as I understand it, if she wins that grant, then she uses the money to purchase the fish. Pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. How did you get introduced to the Audubon Society?
All the time that I've been here, the Audubon, the Delaware Otsego Audubon, has been active in Oneonta. And I kept memberships in that group. I would see their releases in the paper every now and then. Oh my gosh, the programs are on Friday nights. I could go to about one program every year and a half. It was just, you know, busy, busy, busy. How do you get to do that? But I would read the newsletter, read the newspaper releases, and kind of keep track of things that were going on. I always kept a membership at Hawk Mountain in Pennsylvania so I could vicariously see what was going on there. So finally, you know, when I finally retired, then I could get involved and go on the field trips, and then I got, you know, invited to be on the board. I've been invited before to be on the board, but I could never say yes because it just wasn't realistic.
And what year did you start going on the field trips and being involved?
I retired in 2006. I shouldn't say that I didn't go on all the field trips, because the Christmas bird count, I've been doing that for a lot of years. And there was a birding atlas that went on in the year 2000 to 2005. I accepted three areas to research during, I think that was 2003 that I did that. But I could leave school in the spring and run out and check my area and go home. And I could do that. That worked time-wise. I could keep track of it. And we were just looking for evidence of bird nesting, whether the birds were migrating through, whether they were nesting, whether they had young. So you could truly have a real census of what was going on.
What were those areas?
Let's see, Schuyler Lake area and West Winfield area. There were three birding blocks, generally the Exeter State Forest, and they were contiguous blocks. I discovered, once again, there's nothing like going back roading out here. I discovered areas that, you know, it was a privilege to be wandering down this dirt road, wondering where in the world am I going to come out, finding all these terrific birds in the meantime.
Can you talk more about what you liked about those kind of less visited areas?
Oh, the fact that you could just stop your car, there would be nobody, you would expect no one to come by, and hold still and let the birds all just come alive around you. They didn't see people all that much. So once they realized that you're okay, you're sitting still, then the world just comes alive. And it's not just birds. You might see a fox. You might see, oh, there are lots of things that you might see. So just hold still, let them get accustomed to you, and then start observing. Give it time. It takes time. If you want to change your position, go ahead and walk a ways. And once again, settle down and let it all come alive around you. Good fun.
Can you talk about how you decided to become a member of the board?
Well, my good friend Eleanor called me up years ago and said, we want you on the board. And I said, I can't be on the board because you meet Nonianta and I'm busy, and if I'm even able, would even think of being on the board, I'm not going to drive in the snow. And no. So when she knew that I was retiring, she called me back and said, now we want you on the board. I said, I would think about it, but I'm still a scaredy driver. And she said, don't worry about it. If it's too bad for you to drive, we're not having a board meeting anyway. So that sounded reasonable to me. And yeah, it fit. All of a sudden it was time.
What change have you seen in the Audubon since you've been a member?
What change? I've seen a lot more. Well, it's hard to say because the activities have always been huge. Some of the activities that we're now, I'm studying old newsletters, we are, because we're having our 50th year of existence in 2017. So a film festival that they used to have no longer happens. A lot of things that used to be done aren't done anymore, but we're doing a lot of additional things that they didn't initiate. You know, it would be new for them. The things that have been constant have been the Christmas bird count, which is a historic bird count dating from the early 1930s. And the waterfowl count. There are certain things that have been happening right up through since the Audubon's inception. Changes with new board members come new ideas. And sometimes activities will branch out in a certain direction because that particular board member has a passion for it. And that's terrific. That's a great thing.
Can you talk a bit more about the Christmas bird count?
Yes. Back in, I'm going to say about 1900, a man named Frank Chapman had a great idea. I'll backtrack. A popular activity at Christmas time was for households, basically the men in the household, to divide up into two teams and go out for what you would call a side hunt. So they would go out with their guns and they would shoot as many things as they could shoot, and then they would bring these dead birds and animals and so on back, and they would count them up, and whoever had the most kills won the side hunt. And Frank Chapman, he had a great idea. Why don't we just go out and count as many live things as we can and not kill them? So that's exactly what happened. And that's about the time that the environmental movement was happening, and it grew. So one of the original Christmas bird count, let me describe the bird count. It's a 15-mile radius from a center point. So
30 miles across the circle, if it were a circle?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. If that's wrong, we'll edit that.
Yes.
So the center point being in Fort Plain, and the radius now including, oh, south of Sharon Springs, north of the Mohawk River. That area, that whole radius, the whole circle, the count circle is what we call it, was divided into sections, and people volunteer to take certain sections, and they just go out at a certain, you know, early in the morning. You can go out at 3 in the morning if you want to count owls. I've done that too. And you count all day, making sure that you don't double count, and there are ways to do that. You plan your, you learn your route. You plan that if you're going to backtrack through a certain section that you've already been, you don't count the same species again, but if you see a new species, you can count that. It's quite a little science, and it's physically demanding, and it's really fun if you're into it. So at the end of the day, all of the people from the different sections get together. We have a potluck dinner. Not all groups do this, but we do. And talk over our results, hand in our written tallies to the guy who's in charge, and then he sends that to a central reporting area. So it's, again, a real legitimate way of keeping track of what's happening in a certain area at a certain time every year.
Just to clarify, so you count the species and not the individuals?
Both. We count the species and how many of each. So,
and what are the numbers generally like?
You can have from, oh gosh, you know, thousands of starlings and things that are around farms, pigeons and so on, to birds that are rarely in the area around Christmas time, like we had Carolina wrens a few years ago. You don't expect Carolina wrens to be in this part of the country in the wintertime. Numbers, oh gosh, it depends. If the situation is right and turkey populations are high, you can have 400 or 500 turkeys in your section. And if it's a big snowpack and there's nothing for the turkeys, you can have 0 turkeys. And it's very much dependent on the weather condition at the time. I have a special field that I always look for turkeys, but if it's snow covered, I think, there goes my turkey count for this year. So lots of chickadees, lots of house sparrows in the city, like down in the city, Canajoharie. Some years we get robins, not unusual to have robins at that time of year. Bluebirds even, around Christmas time. There, a few of them are still around. And a few surprises, like a catbird, a bird we had a few years ago, really should have been migrated, but it was still around. So it was fun to see it. You can end up with, oh gosh, top of my head, oh, maybe 2,500 birds for the day. It's...
And who participates?
Qualified people that are proven to be knowledgeable, and people who want to learn. So I'm an old-timer, and I try to take at least another old-timer with me so we can work and tally well together. If anyone else wanted to learn how to do it, we'd put them right in the car and teach them, you know, right along the way. So I usually have 2 or 3 people in my car. Teams are usually 2 or 3 or 4 people. I had to do it by myself one year, and the weather was great. I mean, I was out in shirt sleeves, and it was the best year to be doing it by myself because I could get out of the car and look around and really hear stuff. And I felt like I did a pretty good job, but I was also so glad that the weather was as it is. If it had been horrible snow conditions, I would have been paying attention to the road and not so much to the birds.
What is it like to go out at night to look for the owls?
At first, when I was first doing this, I was a little bit spooked because it kind of happens right around deer hunting season. So if you're out at dusk with binoculars going really, really slowly along a road in a fairly remote area, people stop and ask you what you're up to because they think you're jacking deer. Or at least scouting their deer for future, you know. But after a while, the neighborhood gets to know you, and it's terrific fun. I've gone in horrible snowy weather, and I've gone, well, last few years we just haven't had much snow. So, to look for the short-eared owls, which are the Arctic owls that come to this area to winter, it's a matter of finding a good spot, stopping the car, opening the windows, making sure you got lots of clothes on, before sunset, and just starting to scan and starting to really look everywhere. They roost down on the ground in cover. They roost low. So they don't fly in like other birds. Like, you don't look up like you would look for a hawk. You look for this little brown body to kind of appear. It looks like a little hummock. You got to know what you're looking at to know that it's an owl. And then they get active together. They talk a little bit. They make little sounds. And then they start flying and hunting and interacting. And it's absolutely magical. It's a privilege to see that. And I saw it a few days ago. They're here.
Nice.
Yeah.
Can you talk to me a bit about the bait piles?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's been interest from the University of West Virginia, a project going on for probably the last 10, 11 years in documenting the population of golden eagles on the East Coast. So they determined that having these piles of bait, dead deer carcasses, you know, animal entrails that are definitely not shot with lead. It's clean bait that's going to be healthy for the birds to eat. Setting up the bait piles with a trail cam and documenting the comings and goings of all the birds, including golden eagles, was just a really fine way to document where they are and what they're doing. So that has gone right from Maine, I think they have some active ones up in Maine, right down through Tennessee. They've gotten volunteers all along. New York State didn't have a whole lot of activity, and that's when the Audubon, one of our Audubonners, decided, let's get active with West Virginia University and hooked up with their system. So we fundraised, and we purchased the trail cams and got permits from you have to have a permit to collect a deer carcass. You can't just go get one. And, you know, we got all that legal stuff going on, and we've been collecting data for the last, I want to say, 5 years. It's been fascinating.
And where do you get the deer for the piles?
Most of it's roadkill. So the DOT, whoever it is, the county, whoever picks up the carcass from the roadside, there's always a spot where they dump them. And so you can go there and get them. I'm fortunate here because we've got such a nice network going that the folks who collect the carcasses are local, and they drop off to the farmer who helps me with my bait pile, and he puts it in the tractor and takes it to the spot. So I'm a little bit of a princess when it comes to that. It's great. But they're roadkill. And this time of year, well, after hunting season starts, we have to be extremely careful to check those carcasses for bullet holes. Because if they have lead bullets in them and it's not a headshot, we don't want the eagles to eat that meat. Because even if they're copper-coated bullets, they can shatter. And lead fragments can get into the meat, and that lead, even tiny bits of it, can maim and kill the bird. So,
how many carcasses would be in a pile usually?
You try not to put a whole lot out at once. You try, if you have a lot of carcasses, the best thing to do is to pile them up and cover them, tarp them, and maybe, you know, get some snow on top of that, and take up a couple at a time. If there are a whole lot and the coyotes all get onto it, you can really waste a lot of meat quickly. So 1, 2, 3 carcasses is plenty.
And where is the one on the site that you're currently working on?
It's not far from here. It's in a higher elevation. It's on private property, so I can't say exactly where it is, but it's a high point between the Otsego Lake watershed and the into Richfield Springs watershed. So it's way up there. It's just beautiful.
Can you talk a bit about the bird boxes that you work on as a volunteer for the Clark Foundation?
Sure. A few years ago, I'll go back a number of years ago, Don Fenner's grandson was in Scouts. They built a whole lot of bluebird houses. So we put bluebird houses here, there, and everywhere. And then when Bob Sutherland became the manager down here for the Mohican Farm, which is Clark land, his goal was to have as sustainable natural an area as possible. So he got his staff, his guys, one guy in particular who's a woodworker, to build a lot of bird houses. We built wood duck and kestrel houses and bluebird houses. I researched the specs for those houses, and they built them in the wintertime. We put them up a couple of years ago. So every fall, we go and clean them out. And this year, we got a surprise. We found out that the tree swallows that are usually the most aggressive, successful nesters that you can find, they take over bluebird houses in a flash. Had almost 50% of their nestings were failed this year. So it'll be an interesting thing to kind of compare it with other data. And I don't know how to get other data, but it was a pretty significant change. We had one successful bluebird nesting in the place that it always is. So that's a constant. You know, that hasn't gone up or down. But this other thing is interesting.
So when you were researching before building the boxes, what things did you have to consider?
Well, I just went online. I went to Cornell. I went to a lot of different sites who had advice about what the best specs were for what size the house should be, how far from the ground it should be, how far from wetland it should be, based on the particular species. So the wood duck house needed to be near water, not near another wood duck house. The kestrel box, that wasn't too hard because they like open fields, so kind of on the edge of an open field, perfect. And the bluebird needed to be away from the prevailing wind and out in a field that is generally mowed, not a field that has a lot of scrub in it. They like that. Bluebird houses on golf courses, as long as there aren't a lot of insecticides on the golf courses, pretty good. That habitat is kind of what a bluebird likes. Nice, low cropped area to get bugs.
Okay, well, Becky, I want to thank you for giving me your time and for all the information. It's been really great, so thank you.
Well, it's been a delight meeting you and talking with you, and thank you very much, Rosa. I wish you the best this year.
Thank you.
And next year.